Welcome to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Today I'll have an in-depth conversation with dancer, choreographer, and art director Mercedes Ellington, who will be directing Such Sweet Thunder, a symphony space celebration of the life and music of her grandfather, Duke Ellington.
Now, I think that my grandfather had a lot in common with Shakespeare, and they liked to cover the same subject matter, history, the comedy and tragedy, and of course, Shakespeare also did the sonnets.
And WBGO's John Kalish pays tribute to the late David Lerner, who co-founded a popular Macintosh store in Manhattan called TechServe.
After news of Lerner's passing on November 12th reached them, former TechServe employees and customers all over the United States shared memories of the man online.
All this coming up today on the WBGO Journal. The Duke Ellington Center for the Arts, in association with the American Tap Dance Foundation, proudly presenting a spectacular evening celebrating the life and music of jazz legend Duke Ellington. And it's Friday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at Symphony Space, the Peter J. Sharp Theater. The evening is directed by Mercedes Ellington and Tony Vogue. And joining me now is the incredible Mercedes Ellington. Great to see you.
And great to see you too. Great to be seen.
What a wonderful event this is going to be. The music duel director will be Eli Yeaman and the Duke Ellington Center Big Band. Why at this point did you want to have this special celebration for your grandfather?
Well, he liked celebrations. Any excuse, any reason to do an album, which is what he did, because anytime any country had asked him to appear, he would then thank them by writing an album. And I think that the album that we're celebrating is, at this time, you would think maybe it should be a Christmas album or something like that, but we chose to do an album from his visit to England. And that is when people think of England and Shakespeare and literature, Shakespeare comes to mind. Now, I think that my grandfather had a lot in common with Shakespeare, and they liked to cover the same things, the same subject matter, history, the comedy and tragedy. And of course, Shakespeare also did the sonnets in his. And I think that my grandfather, well, first of all, he was his motto was beyond category. So he didn't like to be hemmed down by any situations or any rules and regulations as far as music is concerned, because he liked to, you know, fool around with different types of structures of music and subject matter of music. And so then here we have the Shakespearean suite, which he's dealing now with these characters that Shakespeare wrote about. And he's putting them into a jazz music background.
Such Sweet Thunder is a rarely her complete performance. So this is really a special night.
Yeah, and for some reason, there's a lot of Shakespeare going around at this time, you know, in Broadway musicals and in recordings and concerts and things. And so, I mean, I don't think we were actually affected by that, but it happened that we were planning on doing some concerts that reflected the Ellington catalog.
I'm curious, there's going to be so many great dancers and performers and singers connected with this. At what point did Mercedes tell Father Mercer and Grandfather Duke, I want to be a dancer?
Well, as it turns out, she did not have anything to do with the profession that she ended up in. But the doctor said that I had poor circulation, and being that I was raised by my mother's mother, he suggested to her that she keep me moving. And so she did. I was always in kindergarten. I was in kindergarten when I was 18 months old, and they had a movement section of their in their offering. So I was immediately in that vein. I remember even the shoes that I was wearing. And we did a version. I was a snowflake. One of the roles that I was a snowflake in the Nutcracker. And it was amazing because I was really fascinated with the movement, with the dancers, with the costumes, and also with the music. And that was my first introduction. And after that, I just kept on enrolling as I could, because in those days, there were restrictions color-wise and everything as to where you could study, who you could study with. And I, it was an amazing transition from one thing to the other, from grade school, where grade school, the gymnastic physical therapy that was attached to the curriculum resulted in a woman named Madame Povich, who came every Tuesday to teach ballet. And I remember my grandmother wanted, I was annoyed because I wanted more than the just the Tuesday. And I asked if I could go to her school, which she had a school downtown, Madame Povich's regular ballet school. And I was told every year my grandmother asked if I could be enrolled in the school, and they just kept saying the registration is full. The registration is full. So my grandmother was a very politically minded person. And she actually, my grandmother was from Kingston, Jamaica. And she turns out when my sister, one of my sisters did Ancestry.com, that she was an orphan, but she was Ashkenazi. And she was very determined in her endeavors. She worked at the voting polls and everything. So she was politically minded, and she got tired of being told that the registry was full. So she took me by the hand to the Reverend Mother of the grammar school. And she said, why is this always the answer when no matter how early we come, the registry is full? As it turns out, she didn't really want people of color in the school downtown. So in order to placate my grandmother, she told her that I could have a starring role in the St. Patrick's Night festivities, and I would be having a solo, which was my first introduction to Irish jigs and reels, which led me eventually to tap dancing. And so I, that was the, also she told me that I could be the head angel in the Christmas pageant. So those were the rewards that I got for not having been able to be accepted in the ballet school downtown.
Do you think because of the blood inside you being a trailblazer like your grandfather, a Duke, was, and that that was already kind of a part of you too, to be a trailblazer?
Well, I think I must have inherited the, I don't know what the name would you would call it, but the chutzpah that my grandmother exhibited, and go where no man goes before. I wasn't afraid. I made me a little nervous, but I had friends who were always there to support me, people my age, because they knew nothing about this ridiculous, you know, exceptional rules and regulations, unspoken rules and regulations. And so my equals, they always made me comfortable in the situation. And it went on to through high school. I got a scholarship at the Metropolitan Opera School of Ballet, which was the old Met. They had a school, a ballet school, and I was accepted there. And from there, that gave me a segue into Juilliard, because there were the same teachers from that school into Juilliard. And Juilliard, it just follows you all around, all these connections. And from the Juilliard connection, when I graduated, I was like really floundering around. Now what do I do? You know, then I said, okay, the ballet world is not willing to accept me, so maybe the Broadway world will. And I was looking to be parts of Broadway shows and stuff. And it was at that time, there were a group of us who were all women of color. And we would go to audition for these Broadway shows. And we knew that there was a chance, a big chance, that we would not be accepted because of our color. So we had sort of a club. And we went just to meet and greet with each other. And we said, okay, we'll learn the combination. And the combination, we took it as a free jazz class. So every time we'd go to the audition, you know, and we knew ahead of time that there was a great possibility that we weren't, but it would give us a chance to meet and greet with each other. We'd have coffee afterwards. And so it was, you know, an accepted situation. Even when, I guess it was No Strings, and Diane Carroll was one of the stars. And we said, well, if Diane Carroll is one of the stars, maybe they'll accept some of us as a chorus member or chorus members. But it wasn't happening. And they blamed it on Diane Carroll because they said that she didn't want any distractions. But it was just, you know, it's when you look back at it, it's such a ridiculous situation. The biggest thing and the biggest change in my life is when I became a June Taylor dancer. Now, I don't know if you remember, you may be too young.
I know about the June Taylor dancers. I do know that.
From the sun and fun, the capital of the world, Miami Beach, we bring you the Jackie Gleason Show.
Starring Jackie Gleason and his guests, Robert Goulet, Jack Haley, Alan King, and special guest star, Jack Benny. The June Taylor dancers and Sammy Spear in his orchestra. And away we go.
But do you know about Jones Beach Marine Theater with Guy Lombardo?
I know Guy Lombardo, but I don't know much about the theater. Hey.
Guy Lombardo had a float with his band on it at the Jones Beach Marine Theater. And during the summer, they would put on big, gigantic shows with big casts, singers and dancers. Nowadays, the singers are dancers and vice versa, but they had separate chorus of singers, chorus of dancers. And that's the first time that I had worked for June Taylor. And segue from that, there came a time when somebody, one of the dancers, called me up and said, are you going to audition for the Jackie Gleason show for the June Taylor dancers? And I said, but they are not accepting people of color. I don't think that it's wise for me. And she said, well, it might change, but come over to my house. We'll go on the roof. I'll teach you the combination. I know the tap combination. So I did, and I went, it was like August, on a rooftop, tar rooftop, learning a tap dance combination. So I went, and that was the start of my going every year to audition for the June Taylor dancers. And this one year, I went, and they were auditioning at this hotel, the rooftop area of the hotel. And I said, well, I'm in the mood. I'll just learn the combinations. And I did. They had ballet combination, jazz combination, tap combination. And then, you know, you were set up in a lineup and they eliminated you along the way as to who was the best. And I remember the year that I got to be a June Taylor dancer was the year that Kennedy was assassinated.
Mm.
And so I went up and it was a very exhausting situation because if you can imagine starting out at 10 o'clock in the morning and maybe, I think maybe 4 or 5 in the afternoon was the finish.
Wow.
So at the end of this particular time, we were all in a lineup, and I was counting because along the way they would eliminate June would eliminate maybe two or three people. And I noticed in the lineup that there were only 17. And I said, well, I guess I should get ready to leave, because I was looking around, trying to remember where I left my coat. And I said, well, I'll just go and get my coat and go, because I was scheduled. I knew that there was a tap class that I wanted to take after this audition. So when push came to shove, Gleason walked in the room, Jack Philbin walked in the room, and they started whispering with June. And all of a sudden, June turned to us and she said, ladies, you are the new June Taylor dancers. And I thought she forgot about me, that I should go, you know? And so she said, no, you are the actual June Taylor dancers. And then she came to me and she took me aside and she said, now there's going to be a lot of news about this because of you. And I just want you to know that if you don't live up to the situation and if you make too many mistakes or whatever, I am going to fire you. Because she was known for firing girls every week. If they had holes in their tights, if they didn't wear makeup, they had to wear makeup to rehearsals. And if their hair wasn't done, and if they gained too much weight. And it's so ironic because I ended up being the keeper of the sale of the scales, because she would have me when I ended up, you know, chosen as a June Taylor dancer. I was there for seven seasons, which one season is half a year. Oh. And that first season was in New York. And then Gleason decided to move down to Miami Beach. And that was a trip too, the train down there. But it was an amazing journey, because she was meticulous about the way you looked in your hair, makeup, your tights, your just general. Because in any moment, Gleason could walk into the rehearsal room, and she didn't want him thinking that she had hired a bunch of dogs, you know. So it was just on your toes every second of every day. And I was recently invited to a reunion of the Rockettes of Color. And I was looking at all of the girls there at the party. And I was wondering, they looked so familiar. It wasn't that I knew them, but I knew the body language. I knew the way they talked, and it was like such a throwback into memory lane, you know, because when you are trained as a precision dancer, it's like being trained for the army. It's like a soldier, and you begin to behave naturally the way you are taught to carry yourself on stage. So, It was a trip, really, but I know a few. I still keep in touch with a lot of the dancers, and we sometimes get together and talk about old times, you know. But I just remember June and her concern for me and my welfare, especially when we got to Florida. Because an incident happened on the train when we from the old beautiful Penn Station that they tore down. We took the train because Gleason didn't like to fly, so we were on the Great Gleason Express.
Wow!
I think Jilly catered the train. Steve Lawrence and a Dixieland band played on the train, and it was a real party, you know, going down there. And until we got to the South. And I don't know what state it was, but they wanted us to come out on the platform for publicity and taking pictures and interviews and things. And I didn't want to get out because I said, okay, I know a lot of New Yorkers go to Florida and a lot of New Yorkers are in Miami Beach. But in the South, I just don't want to be around. And I could just see, you know, strange fruit hanging from the trees. So I said, But they didn't have a lot of dancers who made that transition from New York to Miami Beach. So I went out on the platform, lurking in the back near an exit so that if anything happened, I could get back in the train. So I've got big sunglasses, hat, everything. And still, somebody from the back of the crowd yells out, "What's that colored girl doing up there?" And that was giving me the shivers right there. I tell you, I was getting ready to go right back into the train. And Gleason reached out and pulled me under his armpit. And he said, "You stay right here." And I think he never really thought that that would happen. I don't think he was aware that that was a possibility of me being pointed out, you know. And but from then on, I think he made sure that I was okay. Especially when we got to Miami Beach, but there was no problem because there were so many New Yorkers in Miami Beach. I never really ran into that kind of a situation again.
I'm so glad to hear that about Jackie Gleason. So as this performance is going on, what will you be thinking about?
I'll be thinking about what they would think of this performance and that I would be fulfilling their, their hopes, because as I said, my grandmother, my mother's mother, raised me. So I really had little times with my father and my father's side of the family. I would go to see them at the Apollo. My grandmother would take me there, and the orchestra members' wives would sit with me. And at that time, we would see, it would be a movie and a show and a movie and a show, and I was in heaven. And then we'd go backstage and the orchestra members' wives, they would bring fried chicken and I was in heaven. And then after the show, the last show, we'd go down to this wonderful restaurant that had tablecloths on 125th Street and we'd have more fried chicken and food and I was in heaven. And so I just associated good times and meetings with all of these guys. And when they heard that I was dancing, they used to call me the dancer. And I remember being with Billy Strayhorn when I was really, really little. I thought he was another child, so I used to hang out with him because he was my height, you know. And I would like to sit with him whenever we were sitting together. Well, he was great, you know. He was unbelievable, and he was very courteous to me. And he was, because at that time it was, you know, there were no other children around, but I was also very quiet and I wasn't a problem for them to drag me around. But when we went to Russia, that was really the most incredible situation. Nobody knows about this exchange, but my grandfather used to have a glass of Coca-Cola on the piano during the set, and he'd take sips from it, and he'd put sugar in it. And so one of the promoters here in New York, Phoebe Jacobs, she wanted to make sure that he had enough Coca-Cola for Russia. So she calls up Coca-Cola, and they never answered her. So she then thought about Joan Crawford, who was married to Pepsi-Cola. So she called up Joan Crawford, who was a big fan of Duke Ellington's. And Joan Crawford sent over Pepsi Cola with the instructions, just don't let him see the can. So he had all of this. And in turn, Pepsi Cola caught the contract for Stolichnaya. So they brought Stolichnaya back to America. So Stolichnaya became the first Russian vodka in America, and Pepsi-Cola became the first American soft drink in Russia of that trip.
That's a great story.
It's ridiculous, you know.
It's a great one. The Duke Ellington Center for the Arts in association with the American Tap Dance Foundation is presenting this wonderful evening on Friday, December 12th, at Symphony Space's Peter J. Sharp Theater. And it's an evening that is directed by my guest today, Mercedes Ellington and Tony Vogue. It's been an honor to talk to you, Mercedes. Continued success and keep the legacy going.
Okay, and hello to Isaiah, wherever you are.
You can see my entire conversation with Mercedes Ellington on the WBGO YouTube channel. David Lerner was a radio engineer who co-founded a widely admired independent Macintosh store in Manhattan called TechServe. He passed away unexpectedly last month at the age of 72. WBGO's John Kalish has this appreciation.
David Lerner worked at listener-sponsored WBAI in the 1960s and 70s. He and a couple of other engineers from the station started a company that did electronic design using Macs when the first desktop models came out, a design flaw that caused them to overheat and burn out a printed circuit board, sparked a new business repairing Macs. Here's David Lerner in 2016.
Apple charged like $300 to replace the analog board, and we started a little side business of repairing them for, I think, $135. It was this particular lack of a fan overheating defect in the original Mac that started our business opportunity, because we had to fix our own Macs, and then we figured we might as well fix other Macs. So we started a Mac repair business.
Lerner and his partner Dick Deminis opened an independent Macintosh shop called TechServe. It was 14 years before the first Apple stores began selling and repairing Macs. TechServe was in business 29 years. It kept expanding into larger quarters over that time. Its last home was in a cavernous 25,000 square foot storefront on West 23rd Street in Manhattan, a wondrous place where antique radios, old microphones, and some of the first electrical meters lined the walls. Every model of the Mac ever made was displayed in the store, which was the antithesis of the slick, sterile Apple stores, where there's no hint of history. Customers waiting to have their Macs fixed took deli-style tickets dispensed from 20-year-old Macs.
Blue ticket 53.
And enjoyed 10-cent bottles of Coke dispensed from a restored vending machine that was made in the 1950s. When I interviewed David Lerner just before TechServe closed in 2016, he acknowledged that the retail computer space had been transformed since the store opened 29 years ago.
Customers have been incredibly loyal over the years. There's some people who've been buying Macs from us for 20 years or more and getting service from us, and they're very loyal. But the truth is, the world changed.
In 2011, TechServe had $100 million in revenue. But it had a huge workforce of about 200 employees and was paying a fortune in rent. After news of Lerner's passing on November 12th reached them, former TechServe employees and customers all over the United States shared memories of the man online. Former TechServe workers thanked Lerner and Deminis for providing health insurance to full-time employees and free lunch to all their workers.
I've had many different careers in my life and worked in many different places, but without a doubt, you know, David was the fairest and most honest employer I've ever worked for.
Derek Davis worked at TechServe for 11 years. He started the Pro Audio Division. Davis now serves as the head archery coach at Columbia University.
He asked me to come in and we talked for a while. And at the end of it, he's like, when can you start? And he asked me what kind of salary I was looking for. And I had no clue what an Apple technician should make. And I threw out a really low-balled number. And he paused for a second and he's like, I think we can do a little better than that.
The diversity of TechServe's workforce was not surprising, given the roots of its founders at a highly political radio station like WBAI. The store employed white-haired baby boomers, tattooed millennials, women techs, and people of color, including Derek Davis.
I realize now he wasn't hiring technicians, he was hiring family. I've never worked any place where there were so many eclectic people together. They were different, but the same. almost everyone there was a budding creative, you know, either an audio person, music person, or a graphic designer, or a photographer, or a filmmaker, just needing a paycheck till their big break, so to speak. And some of us just got comfortable. It's like, you know what? This is home. And it was just a big family of oddballs.
On the evening of Monday, December 8th, there will be a memorial for David Lerner at Poster House on West 23rd Street in Manhattan. That poster museum now occupies what was TechServe's last home. For the WBGO Journal, I'm John Kalish.
Thanks for listening to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Join us next Saturday morning at 5:30 for another edition of the award-winning WBGO Journal. In the meantime, stay tuned to the world's greatest jazz and blues station, WBGO and WBGO.org.